You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Susan Cain, whose new book is Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Before she became a writer, Susan Cain practiced corporate law for 7 years, representing clients like J.P. Morgan and General Electric, and then worked as a negotiations consultant, training all kinds of people, from hedge fund managers to TV producers to college students negotiating their first salaries. Her clients included Merrill Lynch, Shearman & Sterling, 100 women in hedge funds, and many more. She went to Princeton University and Harvard Law School. On her website bio, Susan Cain writes, "From all this, you might guess that I'm a hardcore, wonderfully self-confident, pound-the-table kind of person, when in fact I'm just the opposite. I prefer listening to talking, reading to socializing, and cozy chats to group settings. I like to think before I speak, softly. I've never given a speech without being terrified first, though I've given many. And somehow I know that everything I've ever accomplished in love and in work I owe to these traits, annoying though they may sometimes be." She explores this paradox in her new book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, which was published earlier this year by Crown. Susan Cain lives on the banks of the Hudson River in an 1822 captain's cottage with her husband, sons, and magnolia trees. Her favorite activities are reading, writing, lounging around cafes, and doing the mambo with her family. She says that she uses a lot of old-fashioned expressions, and a few times a year she tries to like cooking. She's insatiably curious about human nature. I spoke to Susan Cain last week. I first asked her if she'd had the idea to write her book, Quiet, after a specific incident in her life, or if the idea had been marinating for a long time.
I think that the idea has been percolating, honestly, since I was 4 years old. Of course, when I was four, I didn't have a language for the ideas in this book or for the word introvert. But I've been aware of these issues since then. I think many children are, many introverted children. I think I was quite aware that I was the kind of kid who liked to read, who liked to play quietly with friends in one-on-one settings. And, you know, I was kind of mystified by all the group activities that we were obliged to participate in.
Yes.
I liked to go off by myself and do projects, creative projects. I was aware that these things were considered normal in my family, but that when I got outside my family, there was just a kind of mismatch that I think I've been struggling to understand my entire life. And the book was a way of working it out.
So it must have been kind of a relief to get to an age where you realized that this is something you could study, research, and meet other people that were in the same position. And I suppose as an adult, you knew that already. But there must be a point where kids start to realize that they're not alone.
Yeah, but you know what? You're actually right. It's true that as an adult, I did start to feel less alone in this and, you know, start to understand it better. But I didn't really understand it truly until I started writing and researching the book. Because I would say when I first started working on this book, I actually felt sometimes, honestly, I felt embarrassed sometimes to tell people what I was working on, because introversion is so stigmatized in our society. And so, you know, I felt like if I introduced myself as, "Hi, I'm working on this book about introversion," it was like leading with something stigmatizing about my own self. But then over time, you know, as I started to really understand it better and to understand how widespread it is, you know, how many people feel the exact same way that I do and how normal it truly is, you know, a lot of those feelings really started to just melt away.
Right, yeah.
So it's been incredibly empowering that way.
And for other people, too, I imagine you get a lot of feedback from people that it's been very helpful to them.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, that has been the single most, you know, exciting and gratifying aspect of having written this book. I mean, letters flooding in from people, you know, talking about how it's changed their psyches and changed their approach to life. I think there really is a sense of liberation of being able to talk about things that have felt, you know, that you feel like you couldn't admit.
Yeah, yeah. One thing I really loved about the book, and I'll just let me just put the title out there again, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, and it's published by Crown. I love the fact that so much of the book is your research, your conversations with people, you're setting a baseline of understanding for your reader. And then there are moments where you make suggestions about how people who are introverts or perhaps are parents of introverts, you know, might consider moving forward in order to help themselves and their children and their friends and their social lives. But it's not a self-help book. I wouldn't put it in that genre, but it is very helpful and also very scientifically based.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. That was actually, that was a balance I kind of labored mightily to achieve, because I really wanted the book to be of practical help, but I didn't want kind of like a bullet point thing. I wanted it to be sort of more deeply grounded.
Yeah.
So that's something I was trying to do. And you know, one of the chapters that I am most excited about is, it's actually the final chapter, and it's the one about children and what to do if you have an introverted child, and you know how to cultivate that child, how to let them be who they are, but also give them the tools they need to survive in a more extroverted society, but grow into their own wonderfully introverted selves.
Yeah, and one thing that was really interesting when I got to that chapter, I had already read your research about, you know, the statistics of, you know, how many introverts had introverted parents or not, and is this a genetic phenomenon? Are we inheriting our extroversion or introversion? And so that was really interesting. Then you get to the chapter where you realize that, of course, a lot of these parents don't necessarily know what it's like to be an introvert, and so it's hard for them to figure out how to raise this quiet child.
Yeah, that's quite a phenomenon, actually. In fact, I would say the most common family configuration that I run into all the time is introverted. You have two parents. One is an introvert, one's an extrovert. And then let's say you have two children, and again, one's an introvert and one's an extrovert. Now, obviously, there are many variations within this, but I do see these mixed families all the time. And as you say, you know, it can be really challenging for an extroverted parent to have a child with such a different temperament. And there really needs to be a kind of leap of understanding.
Yes.
That can go a long way. And one of the moms who I talk about in the book is a really, you know, kind of hyper extroverted, really dynamic sort of go-getter of a person.
Yeah.
And she has an introverted daughter, and she talks about how at first she would have these experiences, like she would go to pick up her daughter at school at the end of the day and find all the kids playing together in the yard and her daughter off by herself shooting baskets. And she said it was too painful for her to watch. She had to stop going to pick up for a while. And she was also perplexed by it because she knew that her daughter was a very loving, empathetic girl who had a lot of friends. And so she couldn't understand why she wasn't with those friends. You know, why was she isolating herself in this way? But then she started over time to understand what it meant to be an introvert. And she said that it completely changed her way of parenting. You know, so instead of forcing her daughter out to play date after play date, she would sit down and strategize with her. You know, how many play dates work for you? And when do you need to just go home and just talk to your mom or be alone in your room? And, you know, it was like a whole new world opened up once they could understand it through that lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, too, it must be helpful to parents who are raising extroverts, and perhaps they are encouraging their children to, like, invite that quiet little girl over. You know, she definitely could use some more friends or something like that. And I would think that, now my children are too old, I don't have to worry about how how they interact with little ones anymore, because they're making those decisions for themselves. But, you know, I would just think that, looking back, I probably would have let my children just choose their own friends and do their own thing a little bit more than I did. You know, I was always sort of encouraging friendships that maybe, you know, maybe they weren't meant to be. I don't know. So.
Well, I mean, you know, this is such a tricky thing, because none of this is to say that parents can't and shouldn't do a lot of encouraging also.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, especially if you have a child who is either more fearful or just sort of more overwhelmed in social situations. But if as a parent you sense that your child would actually be happy in those social situations once they punch through those inhibitions, then there are steps that you can and should take, you know, to help your child get there.
Right.
But the question is, how do you help them on their own terms? So, you know, instead of pushing them forward, like to act as quickly as a more extroverted child would, you know, you take the time that they need and you go with them step by slow step.
Yes.
To get to the fun on the other side.
Yeah. Early in the book, Susan, you include a test that people can take to decide where they fall on the introvert-extrovert spectrum. And so I took the test, and it was so interesting. I'm sure everybody thinks, you know, they're all so interesting. but as I took the test, I found myself, I've always been an extrovert. I know I'm an extrovert, but I found that the answers that I was, you know, considering, I was doing two things. I was thinking, how would I have answered this question 20 years ago, and how do I answer this question now? And I realized I really have changed. I used to be much more of an extrovert than I necessarily am now. Is that consistent? Do people tend to change in this regard as they age?
Yeah. It's really interesting. Psychologists call this intrinsic maturation. And basically, there are a whole bunch of personality traits where people sort of shift over time. And when it comes to this one, introversion, extroversion, most people do get more introverted with age. Although the interesting thing is you still kind of maintain your ranking, so to speak. So let's say if you think back to where you were in high school compared to your peers, you know, how extroverted were you compared to your peers? And if you now went to your high school reunion, you would probably be more or less the same rank. So if you were the 10th most extroverted person in your class, you'd probably be that still today, but all of you would have shifted over time to become more introverted.
Interesting. Oh, that's really... Now, what role does environment play? Like, for example, my husband's an introvert, you know, or the people you spend most of your time with, if your siblings are introverted or extroverted, or if your parents were, or, you know, I'm environment, not genetics. So will that play a role in how you change?
And how you change over time.
Over time.
Yeah, you know, sure, all these things play a role. Yeah. You know, a lot of it has to do also with what kind of job you have. You know, if you have the kind of job that requires you to be sort of out there all the time.
Right.
That can kind of push you a little bit. Well, it can kind of push you in two different directions. You know, it might make you more extroverted, or it might make you react the other way, you know, where you kind of burn out on it. But in any event, I kind of tend to think those changes tend to be the more superficial ones. I think people are more or less who they are deep down, and what they're changing is more their day-to-day adaptations to their roles.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even in those cases, if you gave them truly the freedom to act exactly as they wished, they would revert back to the way they truly want to be acting.
Okay. In the book, you point out that introverts and extroverts tend to be, you know, equally intelligent based on IQ scores.
Yeah.
So you know, the generalization that the bookish intellectual introvert is smarter, that might not be a true generalization. But what are a few generalizations about introverts and extroverts that are true?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about the one that you mentioned is it is true that introverts tend to be sort of bookish and intellectual. I mean, not all of them, but
okay, more so.
But more so. But what's fascinating about this is that it's not a function of IQ, as you say, that makes them that way. It has nothing to do with intelligence. What it has to do with is it's kind of a preference of how you spend your time. So introverts tend to be more careful. They tend to kind of sit still more. They tend to really focus. If you give them a difficult task to perform, like let's say a hard math problem or that kind of thing, introverts will spend much more time than extroverts will inspecting the problem and analyzing it even before they jump in. And then they'll spend more time working at it and more often get the right answer than extroverts will. And again, that's not about intelligence. It's about a different behavioral style. So it's like the very behavioral style that sometimes gives introverts a bad rap. You know, they're not talking enough, they're sort of slow to make decisions, that kind of thing. That same behavioral style is a real asset intellectually.
Right.
And in fact, we know that introverts get better grades. They win more academic scholarships. They score higher on certain kinds of problem-solving tests, all this kind of thing. And it's all about behavior.
You, in the book, you mentioned That introverts can maintain focus longer. I think you were talking about selling, cold call selling on the phone. And there was this great moment where somebody you interviewed said, well, the extroverts might be doing really well until some bright, shiny thing crosses their path, and then they get off base and they lose their focus. So I assume that's probably the same thing for studying and staying in touch with in school and stuff.
Yep, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. And you know, nowadays, so much of our educational system is focused on having kids work together in groups and teaching each other. And I have a lot of issues with that for all kinds of reasons. But one of my issues is I think this is doing extroverted children a disservice, because these kids, to begin with, are not, it's not as easy for them to kind of sit still and focus and persist in these kinds of ways. And yet being able to sit down and work by yourself is such a crucial skill.
Right.
So we need to be teaching, you know, introverted kids will more or less figure out that skill, whether it's presented to them or not, because it's their nature. Extroverted kids won't do it unless you teach them how. So I think it's really important that we teach them.
Yeah.
Because we know, like, there's this amazing psychologist, Anders Ericsson, who did groundbreaking work on how we acquire expertise. Like, how do people get to be really amazing at what they do? And so he studied expert performers in all different realms, from tennis players to chess players to mathematicians and musicians. And he found that all these people engaged in this thing that he calls deliberate practice, where you sit down by yourself and you practice in a really intense, focused way on your craft. You practice your craft. And you do it in this way where you're always working on the point that is a little bit challenging to you. Like, not too challenging, but just challenging enough. And it's the people who do that well and who know how to do it who succeed. And very often, he says, this work needs to be done alone. So, you know, kids who are not, or adults who don't have the wherewithal to be able to sit still by themselves and do this, really, they might be very talented and not be able to nurture that talent. So that's why it's so important that we be teaching it.
That's such a good piece of advice for writers, because we have to be able to sit alone and work.
Yes. Yeah, this is true. And, you know, it's so funny that you say this. I was just talking last night with a woman who's a writer and an extrovert, and she was saying this is one of the hardest things for her as a writer. You know, it's one of the places introverts have an advantage, because it's kind of easy for an introvert to sit by themselves with their laptop, right?
And yeah,
like, for me, that's one of my favorite parts of my day, when I get to be alone with my laptop. I love that. But for many extroverts, they have a kind of approach avoidance conflict, where they're drawn to write and they're drawn to express, and they might be very beautiful writers, but the act of sitting down by themselves to make all of that happen is difficult and like something that they have to surmount every day.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of like the mirror image of the kinds of things that introverts often have to surmount every day, you know, where introverts have to sort of push themselves forward to be more social than they might like.
Yeah. I found it really interesting in the book. You mentioned that you like working in a cafe. And I thought to myself, because I used to try that, and it was just like the buzz and activity around me in a cafe was so distracting, I couldn't do it. So I need to be in a completely quiet, sealed off space. But it's interesting because, and maybe I'm overdoing this generalization thing, but maybe as an introvert, you can kind of focus and tune it all out a little more or something.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. I have definitely noticed that phenomenon too. And my husband is an extrovert and a writer, and he used to come to the cafe where I wrote my whole book, and he would be like, how do you even, he said, I couldn't even write a postcard here. it was just so distracting for him.
That's so funny.
I think that's right. I think extroverts, when they're in that kind of a situation, often feel like an impulse to be engaged with it all. Mm-hmm. And so they can't be there and also focus. And for an introvert, you don't feel, as you say, this is general stuff, right? Because everyone feels differently. But I do think for many introverts, you're in that kind of setting, you don't feel the impulse to be engaged with it at all. I think what you feel is sort of the pleasure of being around other people. And it's actually nice to not have to talk to them. I think many introverts feel this way. Like, they would be happy to go to a party if they didn't have to be chatting the whole time. Like, if they could just be watching. They would enjoy it a lot more, but it's not socially acceptable to go to a party and just watch. But at a cafe, you can do that.
Yeah, that's true. Well, Susan, I'm wondering if maybe this is a good time for you to read a couple pages from the book.
Sure, I would love to. I think what I'll do is I will read a little section from the introduction.
Great.
To give listeners a sense of what the book is all about.
Okay, and I'll just say that this is Susan Cain reading from Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, published by Crown.
Our lives are shaped as profoundly by personality as by gender or race. And the single most important aspect of personality, the north and south of temperament, as the scientist J.D. Higley puts it, is where we fall on the introvert-extrovert spectrum. Our place on this continuum influences our choice of friends and mates and how we make conversation, resolve differences, and show love. It affects the careers we choose and whether or not we succeed at them. It governs how likely we are to exercise, commit adultery, function well without sleep, learn from our mistakes, place big bets in the stock market, delay gratification, be a good leader, and ask what if. And here I'm just inserting a note for listeners that the answers to all these questions can be found in the book. Okay, it's reflected in our brain pathways, neurotransmitters, and remote corners of our nervous systems. Today, introversion and extroversion are two of the most exhaustively researched subjects in personality psychology, arousing the curiosity of hundreds of scientists. These researchers have made exciting discoveries aided by the latest technology, but they're part of a long and storied tradition. Poets and philosophers have been thinking about introverts and extroverts since the dawn of recorded time. Both personality types appear in the Bible and in the writings of Greek and Roman physicians. And some evolutionary psychologists say that the history of these types reaches back even farther than that. The animal kingdom also boasts introverts and extroverts, from fruit flies to pumpkin seed fish to rhesus monkeys. And as with other complementary pairings, like masculinity and femininity, East and West, liberal and conservative, humanity would be unrecognizable and vastly diminished without both personality styles. And yet we make room for a remarkably narrow range of personality types. We're told that to be great is to be bold, to be happy is to be sociable. We live with a value system that I call the extrovert ideal, the omnipresent belief that the ideal self is gregarious, alpha, and comfortable in the spotlight. The archetypal extrovert prefers action to contemplation, risk-taking to heed-taking, certainty to doubt. He or she favors quick decisions, even at the risk of being wrong, works well in teams, and socializes in groups. We like to think that we value individuality, but all too often we admire one type of individual, the kind who is comfortable putting himself out there. Sure, we allow technologically gifted loners who launch companies in garages to have any personality they please, but they are the exceptions, not the rule, and our tolerance extends mainly to those who get fabulously wealthy or hold the promise of doing so. But we make a grave mistake to embrace the extrovert ideal so unthinkingly. Some of our greatest ideas, art, and inventions, from the theory of evolution to Van Gogh's sunflowers to the personal computer, came from quiet and cerebral people who knew how to tune into their inner worlds and the treasures to be found there. Without introverts, the world would be devoid of Newton's theory of gravity, Einstein's theory of relativity, Yeats's The Second Coming, Chopin's Nocturnes, Proust's In Search of Lost Time, Peter Pan, Orwell's 1984, The Cat in the Hat, Charlie Brown, the films of Steven Spielberg, Google, co-founded by introvert Larry Page, and Harry Potter. As the science journalist Winifred Gallagher writes, the glory of the disposition that stops to consider stimuli rather than rushing to engage with them is its long association with intellectual and artistic achievement. Neither EMC squared nor Paradise Lost was dashed off by a party animal. And there you go.
Thank you very much for reading that. I love that last sentence there.
It's a great quote.
It's a great one. This is a quote from the book, Dale Carnegie's metamorphosis from farm boy to salesman to public speaking icon is also the story of the rise of the extrovert ideal. And you did talk a little bit about the extrovert ideal right now. And I'm just wondering if we can talk just a little bit more about that, about the extrovert ideal and why it is so prevalent, especially in this country. It sounds like there are other countries where it does not have quite the impact that it has here. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, the extrovert ideal is basically a value system that we all live with that says that the ideal self is very bold, very gregarious, very comfortable in the spotlight. And And for us in Western cultures, this is partly part of our cultural DNA. You know, we're founded on Greco-Roman ideals, and those ideals have always celebrated great oratory. But still, up until the turn of the 20th century, this was still a country, the United States I'm now speaking of, was still a country that where it was okay to be an introvert, too, because we lived then in what historians call a culture of character, where people valued you based on your inner self, based on are you a good person or not. Mm-hmm. But then what happened is we started moving into the cities. People started taking jobs in corporate America, and instead of working alongside people they had known all their lives, now they had to stand out in a crowd of strangers. And so qualities like being very magnetic and dynamic and personable became all important. And this is when we moved into what historians call a culture of personality. And that is still the society we live in today. It was around this time, the turn of the 20th century, that Dale Carnegie wrote How to Win Friends and Influence People, his famous book. And if you look, that book today on Amazon is still number 200.
Oh, my gosh.
Like almost 100 years after it was written. It's still a top seller. So we still very much live in that sort of a culture. And as you suggest, it's not the same the world over, particularly in Far Eastern societies and traditional Far Eastern cultures. There's much more of an emphasis on group harmony. And the way you cultivate group harmony is by having each individual be more quiet, more unassuming, more careful with words. And so in these cultures, people who are more reserved are seen as wise and judicious and strong because they have the strength to have restraint. Whereas we see strength as being the strength to put yourself out there. It's almost like a mirror image ideal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although, in thinking about all this, I'm also realizing that there's putting yourself out there in a way that's irritating to people, too. And I think that quiet people are respected for their reserve here, but there's a certain kind of extrovert that is just, gregarious, and people are drawn to that person. There's also the person you really avoid at a party because they just never let you get a word in edgewise, and I don't know. There's different types of both, I guess.
That is true, and I should say with all of this stuff, like almost every single thing I've said today, in a sense, there's more complexity than you can kind of convey while also conveying the main point. There are definitely variations with all of this. And in fact, one of the things that I tried to do in the book is present portrait after portrait of people who are quiet and yet people are drawn to them and yet they're very powerful, they figure out ways to be powerful in their quiet. I think that the real challenge for many quiet people is figuring out, okay, most of them are aware of some kind of a cultural bias against their way of being. So first, how do you process that bias? How do you rise above it without letting it affect your psyche and your vision of yourself? Mm-hmm. And then just sort of more practically speaking, okay, how do I take my temperament and really make it powerful? One of the things I showed in the book is so many creative people who have done that. And then also, in a way, most interesting and surprising to me was how many quiet leaders there are.
Yes.
I think we don't think of leaders as being this way. We think of leadership as being almost necessarily an exercise in being very dynamic, very sort of classically inspiring,
Right.
And yet so many of our transformative leaders, many have been extroverts, but many have been introverts too. People like Gandhi, people like Rosa Parks, people like Eleanor Roosevelt. These were all people who hated the spotlight, hated it. And yet they took the spotlight because they were drawn by the cause that they cared about. And it turns out that that has a strangely paradoxical power because these people's followers could sense that they were doing what they did not out of a love of the spotlight, but out of a desire to affect change. And people can feel that kind of authenticity.
Yeah, and I thought that was really interesting in the book when you talked about some of these quiet leaders who were so effective at leading extroverts, actually, in a lot of cases. But I also was thinking about that when I was reading this. I was thinking, sadly, in our voting system, I suspect we don't vote in America for the introverts anymore because it seems like so much of who we vote for has to do with coming across well on television and speaking up and speaking confidently. And do you agree with that, or am
I? Well, it's funny. No, I mean, Yes and no. I do agree with that in general. But I would also say that right now we might have the first presidential race in history between two introverts. I think Obama is probably an introvert, and I think Romney probably is as well.
That's interesting. Okay.
You know, and there are a lot of introverts with really strong social skills, and I think that both of these men would be in that category.
Oh, that's really interesting. So, and you did talk about in the book, you know, sort of how introverts can become more comfortable and confident in public speaking situations and in situations where they have to sort of present themselves as extroverts, even if it's just briefly because it's for a cause they're passionate about. But that must be really hard. They're doing it all the time on the campaign trail.
I know, but you know, public speaking is a funny thing. Well, first of all, a lot of people who are uncomfortable with public speaking are shy, and I don't think that either Obama or Romney is shy. I just think they're introverted, you know, in the sense of preferring environments that are a little quieter and more thoughtful, as opposed to sort of being out in the hurly-burly.
Yeah.
And so there is a subset of introverts who are quite comfortable with public speaking. I think both of them are probably in that category. But, you know, if you look at President Obama, he delivers really fantastic speeches when he knows he needs to. I think he's kind of a classic introvert in that he rises to the occasion when he needs to do it.
Mm.
But I don't think it's his cup of tea. And I think that that's why he is often faulted for he's sometimes criticized for seeming lackluster or for not socializing enough in Washington. And I think probably a lot of that is him being sort of a natural introvert, but then he sort of pulls it out when he needs to.
That's really interesting, yeah.
You know, and as opposed to, let's say, a more classic politician like a Bill Clinton, where you just feel like he couldn't really live and he couldn't have energy if he weren't out and around crowds all the time. I think Obama probably the exact opposite. You know, to live and to be energetic, he needs to retreat.
Okay. You tell the story in the book of the bus to Abilene, which is an interesting concept in the United States Army. If a group of people end up on a bus to Abilene, and then when they get there, they can never decide whose idea was this anyway. I never really wanted to come here. Is that sort of the gist of it?
Yeah. Well, it's the idea that that you might all be sitting around on a porch on a lazy Sunday, and one person says, "Hey, let's take a bus to Abilene." And just because somebody has initiated action, everybody will just kind of follow lockstep, and suddenly you have the whole group on a bus to Abilene. And in fact, no one ever really wanted to go.
Okay.
But they followed the action person. And this is apparently like a real trope in the U.S. Army. Whenever they are worried that they're just sort of all acting in a group, they'll say, "Are we getting on a bus to Abilene here, or do we really want to be going in this direction?"
Right. I loved that. And you wrote in the book, "This reveals our tendency to follow those who initiate action, any action." But here's another thing that you said in the book. "If we assume that quiet and loud people have roughly the same number of good and bad ideas, then we should worry if the louder and more forceful people always carry the day. This would mean that an awful lot of bad ideas prevail while good ones get squashed." So I'm assuming that that's sort of relevant to the bus to Abilene, where it's just sort of like the louder people are convincing a group to go in a certain direction that maybe not the best direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I think that this is one of the great problems that afflicts our culture, because we do live in a society, you know, psychologists have shown this again and again, where we all have a tendency to follow the opinions of the most assertive or most charismatic person in the room. And yet there is, as you were just suggesting, there is zero correlation between being the best talker and having the best ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such a huge problem, because so the most charismatic person in the room might at any given point have the best idea, but they might not. And so how crazy is it for us as a society to tend to follow always that person's opinions? We'd be so much better off if we could figure out a way around this bias that we all tend to have. So I think this is one of the great challenges, especially for workplaces or for any kind of organization that needs to be making important decisions. How can you get the best of everybody's brains? And how can you decide who has the best ideas without being held sway to, mm-hmm. you know, to personal charisma?
Right.
And one way that people are starting to do this is by using online channels. There's one really interesting company called Right Solutions, where they've developed an online stock market, where anybody can online advance an idea that they think the company should research. And if other people think it's a good idea, they can invest their nominal stock market cash, they can sign up to work on that project. And they did this explicitly because they wanted to harness the quiet geniuses in the company who they knew were not the ones who were going to come forward in a meeting with their ideas. And it's been incredibly successful. They've had a number of really profitable initiatives that have come out of this process. We're probably only scratching the surface on what we can do.
I would think that another complication to this is that the charismatic people in a group are used to always being listened to and recognized, and so they maybe even have a little bit less hesitance to, you know, or they think less about their ideas before throwing them out there, just because they're so used to everybody agreeing that they are, you know, the ones with the good ideas.
That is such a good point. It's a really good point. And I think also, you know, to the extent that they're extroverts, they're also less likely to think before advancing their ideas, only because for extroverts, the thinking process is to think out loud. For introverts, the thinking process is that you think first and then you speak. Now, that there's a real downside to that, because what it means is introverts say this all the time. They go into meetings. They don't think of the thing that they wanted to say until 5 minutes after everybody has stopped talking about it already. Like, the discussion's moved on, and that's when they have their idea. And by then, it's too late. You know, so extroverts are much better off in that they can, you know, kind of think on the fly. But yeah, it does mean that the ideas that aren't yet fully prepared are the ones that get advanced to the group.
So we really need
each other. Like, that's my fundamental conclusion. Introverts and extroverts need each other desperately because we each have strengths that the other one is just completely lacking. And we need to kind of put them together, and then we'll all be best off.
One question I had when I was reading this, I was looking at the title of the book, okay, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. And you know what? It seemed to me like that was a title that was invented by an extrovert. Does that sound crazy?
Oh, that's so funny. I actually wanted to call the book Shake the World Gently, because there's this great Gandhi quote that I have in the book where he says, in a gentle way, you can shake the world. And, you know, to me, that's the premise of everything I'm saying. But it was felt that, and I'm sure, you know, my advisors were right. They felt that was too poetic a title, and nobody would know what on earth the book was about. So we did not go with that title.
How are you finding the whole process of marketing your book and doing the publicity, being on a book tour, talking to people like me? Is that something that you're comfortable with?
You know, it's funny. It's something that I'm comfortable with because I care so much about what I'm saying in the book, you know, and about advancing these ideas, that helps me transcend my normal discomfort to being in the spotlight. It is incredibly exhausting for me, for sure. And I have to take all kinds of breaks, and I have to pace myself. I think that's probably true for any writer on book tour. I think it's an exhausting experience. And I think probably most writers are introverts, but they just don't talk about their exhaustion.
I was really struck. There's a point in the book where you interview a director of human resources at a big media company, and that person said creative people, and what he or she meant was outgoing, fun, and jazzed up people. And I was like, I don't think so. I mean, a lot of creative people are not outgoing. And anyway,
I know. And yet there really is a misperception, I think, that, you know, I think we think of creative people as being, you know, they're sort of like bouncing around, very colorful, and definitely a lot of creative people are that way. But then there are the ones who are more sort of off by themselves and being very contemplative and turning things over in their minds, you know, very different styles.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I kind of cut you off. You were talking about the book tour.
No, you know, just to say, yes, it's a very apt question. And before the book tour started, I was kind of dreading it, frankly. Like, I just didn't know how I was going to handle it. Now that it's here, I do find that I'm so excited to be getting this message out that, you know, on balance, it's a great thing. But it's also, it's a challenge for sure.
Yeah.
My publisher's been amazing about it. You know, because I wrote a whole book about introversion, they know all this. So, so my publicist is always really solicitous. Like, okay, we have you. you know, set for two radio interviews, and then I give you a break after that. You know, so she's really quite lovely.
Okay.
And that helps.
You have a chapter in the book on collaboration, which I found very interesting, and particularly I found it very interesting having been in a lot of writing groups and writing workshops, and I just wonder if we can talk about that from that perspective. Just collaboration as a, is it a positive or a negative thing, and for writers who might be in writing groups or writing workshops, what that might mean for them.
I think collaboration can be a wonderful thing. I mean, my critique of collaboration in the book is that we are now... That our culture has gone so crazy for all things collaboration that we now throw people together into groups, you know, just too much of the time, and we don't spend enough time valuing solitude. I think that a writer's group that's working well can be an incredible thing. And what it really means is, you know, you're spending all week going off by yourself and doing your writing, and then you come together with a group of trusted people with whom you share that work. And in fact, I will say this book wouldn't exist probably had I not been a member of a writer's group.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I actually, when I stopped practicing law, I took a class in creative nonfiction at NYU, and it turned out to be this amazing class of people where we all really clicked. And so even when the semester was over, we all stayed together in a writer's group for years. It probably lasted about 4 years, and we shared each other's work. And I remember when I came up with the idea for this book, I told one of the members of that group about the idea, and she loved it, and she said, as soon as you're ready, I know a literary agent who will love this idea. And I always had that in the back of my mind, and a year later I had written a proposal and sent it to that agent, and his name is Richard Pine, and he became my agent.
Oh, wonderful.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and in fact that same woman who connected me with my agent is now publishing her first novel in the next year. And so we've been helping. And gosh, we enrolled in this class back in 2001. And so the writer's group itself is no longer in existence.
Yeah.
But we're all still in touch and cheering each other on. And I think it's been an amazing thing.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
You studied creative nonfiction. So did you ever start writing memoir or creative nonfiction work?
Yeah, in fact, I started off writing memoir. And the first thing I did was I wrote a memoir both in prose and also in verse, believe it or not.
Oh, wow.
And I don't know, somehow I just decided not to publish it. I guess partly it felt too personal, partly I just wasn't ready. And so that's actually sitting in my hard drive, and maybe one day I'll resurrect it. And then I wrote plays. I wrote all kinds of stuff for a few years, and then started working on this book.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about people being reward-oriented and threat-oriented?
Yeah. This is a fascinating thing. Psychologists have found out that some people have in their brains more active reward networks. These are the networks that involve heavily the neurotransmitter dopamine. And these are the networks that get us excited when we contemplate the prospect of a reward, like getting a promotion at work or chatting with somebody who you think is really handsome. That's all reward stuff. And extroverts tend to be have more active reward networks than introverts do.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean introverts don't have them. They do, but they're just not quite as jazzed up as extroverts are. So reward networks are quite a lovely thing, and they tend to be accompanied by really strong, happy emotions, which I think is part of what makes extroverts such lovely company.
You know,
I think they're often sort of in the throes of these happy emotions, like, oh, let's go do this fun thing. and it's kind of like an infectious enthusiasm.
Yeah.
However, the downside of that kind of way of being is that you don't tend to see warning signals quite as clearly. You might not be seeing reality in a way quite as clearly because you're sort of orienting to the reward and
okay.
You're not seeing other stuff that's around it. Whereas introverts tend to have a kind of more careful, more circumspect style. Warren Buffett, perfect example. He's an introvert. He's well known for having not gotten caught up in the big finance crises, you know, that felled other investors.
Yeah.
And it's funny because when we think about introverts and extroverts, we don't tend to think in terms of these sort of risk-reward dichotomies, but they really are relevant. In fact, extroverts have been found to get into more car accidents than introverts, to commit adultery more often, to place larger financial bets, and it's all connected to this sort of higher risk, higher reward style of being.
Yeah, there's a quote in the book where you're talking about buzz, which is a little bit different, but buzz being the excitement.
Really,
yeah. And you wrote buzz is JFK's Camelot, but it also is the Kennedy curse. And I thought that says it, doesn't it? That sort of says it's like it's very exciting to have the buzz and the excitement and the motivation that comes with it, but there's danger to it too, as you say in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's why I keep saying that we really need each other so much. I mean, I think the world would be a lot less colorful and maybe not have quite the same momentum without the extroverts among us. But it would also be out of control if it were only extroverts.
Yeah,
you know, we need each other.
So by extension, I just wanted to just quickly ask: so are introverts more threat oriented typically, or?
Not necessarily. Some introverts are and some are not.
Oh, okay.
They're sort of two different axes. So introverts, they're less likely to get that crazy excitement thing that extroverts get.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't necessarily mean that they're then oriented to focusing on danger signals.
Okay.
To actively focusing on them, although a subset of introverts are like that.
All right. Okay. Well, Susan, I just have one last question for you. What advice might you have for writers who are introverts and writers who are extroverts?
That's a great question. I mean, for writers who are introverts, I guess I would say, number one, take delight in your introversion because it is a huge asset in your writing that you might not be aware of, but it's really a gift to be able to sit still and be quiet the way you can be. The challenge is more likely going to be making sure that you stay networked so, you know, that when you do have that proposal written, you have a friend who has the right agent for you, you know, and can help you in that way and that you're helping others too. So, you know, maybe to push yourself to join a writer's group or that kind of thing. Extroverts kind of have the mirror image set of challenges and benefits. You know, I think of Rick Warren, the pastor who wrote The Purpose-Driven Life, mm-hmm. which is one of the great-selling books of all time. He talks about how the 7 months that he spent writing that book were torture for him because it was so hard for him to sit down and be alone working. So I think for extroverts, you're going to need to to come up with systems that work for you where you can sit down for a period of time but know you're going to get your social juice at the end of it. And maybe that means you have a three-hour writing chunk, but you have lunch plans with a friend for right after so that you know you're going to get your social fix.
That's a great idea. Okay. Well, this is great. Susan Cain, the book is Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking, published by Crown. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Oh, it was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Susan Cain. The book is fantastic. And you can read more about her work at her website, thepowerofintroverts.com. Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by my conversation with Susan Cain. The 10th chapter of her book, Quiet, is called The Communication Gap, How to Talk to Members of the Opposite Type. So in other words, how extroverts can speak to introverts and vice versa. The chapter begins with this paragraph, quote, "If introverts and extroverts are the north and south of temperament, opposite ends of a single spectrum, then how can they possibly get along? Yet the two types are often drawn to each other in friendship, business, and especially romance. These pairs can enjoy great excitement and mutual admiration, a sense that each completes the other. One tends to listen, the other to talk. One is sensitive to beauty, but also to slings and arrows, while the other barrels cheerfully through his days. One pays the bills, and the other arranges the children's playdates. But it can also cause problems when members of these unions pull in opposite directions." End quote. So consider this paragraph and then write a scene or a poem that includes dialogue between an introvert and an extrovert. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please go to the Write the Book Radio Show Facebook page and like us. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show, suggestions about who you'd like to hear interviewed, news about book-related events, if you have a writing prompt to suggest, please send an email. The email address is writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.